You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many food experts like Michael Pollan and Alice Waters are recommending that we eat at home more often, and it can be so expensive to eat out. But that can be a problem if you're like many New Yorkers and have a really tiny kitchen, which is why for part three of our Food in the City series, we have invited award-winning food writer Melissa Clark to give us tips about how to deal with preparing a decent meal in a small city apartment. Melissa is a frequent contributor to the Wednesday food section of the New York Times, where she writes the A Good Appetite column. She has some 26 cookbooks under her belt, including Braise, a collaboration with Chef Daniel Ballou, and A Billion Delicious Desserts with White House pastry chef Bill Yosis, and that one's coming out next year. I'm very pleased that she has made a return visit to our show. Hi.
Hi, good to be here.
Have you ever had a decent-sized kitchen in New York?
This is the first time in my life. I live in Brooklyn right now, and I finally have a kitchen that's big enough where I can stretch my arms out from one side to the other and not touch any walls. It's liberating.
And you bought the place. So I'm sure that was a major consideration when you were looking.
Absolutely.
How small was the smallest kitchen you've had at home?
The smallest one I had was about as big as this table that actually it was smaller than this table that we're sitting at. It was probably, I could wash the dishes, open the fridge, go to the stove, and not step anywhere. There was no counter. The sink was, butt up against the refrigerator on one side, the stove on the other, and that was about it.
And we had we did a video of you cooking in a friend's small kitchen.
It brought back such memories.
And one of the things that brought back a lot of memories for me was that the refrigerator door couldn't open all the way.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the stove was so small, I don't think you could get a 12-pound turkey in that.
When I was looking for an apartment not so long ago, I saw places where you couldn't open the broiler of a stove. I was wondering what they were thinking.
They're thinking New Yorkers don't cook. That's exactly what they're thinking, and that's exactly what we want to dispel and we want to change.
And the stove that you were cooking in your friend's apartment is one of those half stoves, those
exactly.
Little mini New York four burner,
but you really could
put one pot in all four.
Right, they shrink down the burners so that you think you're getting a four burner stove, but in fact you can fit about a 10-inch skillet in comfortably, and that's about it.
And there's something sort of torturous about the fact that there are so many great ingredients available in this area nowadays, just begging to be cooked, and kitchens that are so tiny, it's hard to cook them.
It's hard, but it's not impossible. And I did it for years. And I know, okay, people will say, oh, but you're a food professional, you had to do it. But even before that, when I was in college, I just loved to cook. And I think that if you love to cook, you figure out a way to do it.
You used to be a caterer out of your apartment, out of the current place or one of the teeny places?
No, out of one of the teeny. I used to cater out of the apartment I was just describing to you. And what I would do is I had my living room became my kitchen when I was working, or I would have to rent a kitchen for big parties. But you can do a lot in a very small space. And what I learned was to become extremely efficient. And I think as a caterer, you have to be efficient. But home cooks, too. I mean, if you just take 5 minutes before you start a recipe and actually read it over and think the steps out. Every cookbook tells you to do that. And I think in New York, when you have a small kitchen, you have to do that. You have to have your game plan. Like, okay, where am I going to put my pot? And when the pot is cooling, is my cooling rack set up? My cooling rack was on the floor of my living room. So, you don't have to have the cooling rack in the same room. Things like that.
That was a lesson that I learned, unfortunately, through hard experiences, like being in the middle of cooking something and saying, oh, I didn't chop up the parsley.
Right. And if you're in a small kitchen, you have no space to chop up the parsley because your cutting board is over your sink and then you've moved it. So you have to have your mise en place set up. Some cooks will say, mise en place meaning just have all your ingredients ready right before you start cooking. And some cooks say, well, I like to cook as I go. That's fine if you have the space. But if you don't have the space, you need to think ahead.
You mentioned putting your cutting board over the sink. Now, you have all sorts of tips that you include in this video. By the way, you let Benjamin Walker and Andrea Salenzi from our culture department videotape you in your friend's apartment. Jamie Young. I wondered why she took a place in a kitchen like that.
It's a beautiful place.
Well, people can see the result on our show page at WNYC.org. And she just moved there recently. This was a step up, she said, from prior kitchens.
Yeah, her last kitchen was even smaller. And when people see the video, you're going to wonder, well, how could it have been smaller? I can't imagine it any smaller, but
So you had all sorts of suggestions. One of them is to add to counter space by getting a cutting board that fits over the sink.
This was a tip that I actually learned from my husband, who, when I met him, had a kitchen even smaller than the one. I mean, the kitchens just get smaller and smaller and smaller. And he bought a giant wooden cutting board, a really thick one. This is important that it's thick because you want it to be solid. And he put it right over his sink, and that was his counter. And it
works
beautifully.
You don't want it shifting around.
Right. You want it to be solid. You want it to actually fit entirely over the sink. Either if you have a big sink, you can put it kind of lengthwise, or you could put it over the whole thing. But just buy a big, thick cutting board. And this is the kind of thing that when you stand it up, you can hide it really easily. You can put it on top of the fridge. So you just bring it out when you need a counter space or you need to chop something.
I noticed that you use only one large knife. Don't most serious cooks keep a selection of specialty knives?
You know, when you have a small kitchen, you need to pare down, no pun intended. You need, I think, two knives, a paring knife and a good chef's knife. If you have those two knives, you don't need anything else. And you don't need gadgets and you don't need a food processor. You really, you know, think of your kitchen as like, you know, as a ship. Every single thing on it needs a ticket to be on there. You know, it needs a reason for the voyage. You need to have, it just needs to be sort of, ship shape. It needs to be tight fitting. So why do I have a food processor? Do I really use, I mean, if you're the kind of person who knows you're going to use it constantly, okay, you can let it in. But otherwise, you know, just say no. Say no to gadgets.
The big problem is there are these recipes that say, put all these ingredients in the food processor and
Right.
run it for so much time. And it's hard to imagine how you might do it otherwise. In the old days, they would have said,
blender.
Do it this way.
Right.
If you have a food processor.
Exactly. And
They do assume.
I try to write all my recipes, not making that assumption, maybe because I'm from New York. A blender usually works just as well. A blender has a much smaller footprint in your kitchen than a food processor does. Another trick is I had a bookcase outside my kitchen, and I had all my equipment on the bookcase, and I would just take the thing that I needed. So if it was a blender or if it was a food processor. I mean, as a professional, I needed these things, but as a home cook, choose one or the other.
My guest is Melissa Clark, who is actually appearing on television, so to speak.
Television at your desk.
The James Beard Award-winning food writer who writes the Sunday A Good Appetite dining column for the dining section, the New York Times. And she has participated in our Food in the City series, part three. This one about cooking in a small kitchen. You talk about keeping the number of things you use limited, yet you used a garlic press, something I don't have.
Yeah, it's true. You don't need a garlic press. A garlic press is one of those things that I've always had. I grew up using a garlic press, and a lot of chefs will say, oh, don't use a garlic press.
They don't like what it does to the oil.
They don't.
Garlic.
Exactly. They don't like that. I don't mind it. And I find that when I have a lot of things going on, like I'll have four things that I need to chop on the cutting board, and that's all ready. If there's no room for the garlic, then it doesn't need to be there. And so I use the garlic press specifically just to show people that, say that you don't even want to chop anything. You can make that. I made a shrimp dish for people who want to check it out on the video. It's shrimp, garlicky shrimp with feta cheese and cilantro and lemon.
And how did you come up with that?
Well, the garlic shrimp that's a great small kitchen recipe, and that's something I've used my whole life. You don't even need the other ingredients. If you use oil, garlic and shrimp and a little bit of salt and saute that in a pan together, it is magical. It's a wonderful dish. And I added the feta because of one of your listeners, actually, who wrote in and said that I think the question was Michael LaMonaco asking how do you change a recipe to suit you? And I think she was from Mexico and said that she made enchiladas in the United States. Instead of finding queso fresco or cotija cheese like she would find at home, she found feta cheese here, and she loved the flavor and the texture was very similar. And I thought, feta. Feta is a great thing to use in any kind of dish where you want a lot of flavor really quickly. You don't even need to chop it. You don't need to grate it. You just crumble it into your dish, and it melts and creates a pan sauce.
It has a little bit of sourness, which is
mm-hmm.
fun.
Exactly.
But you also add other ingredients like capers.
Right.
Capers goes particularly well with seafood, doesn't it?
Capers are fabulous with seafood. They're great with chicken. And the good thing about capers in a small kitchen, and this is another really important point that I want to make, is that like your equipment, your ingredients, your fridge is small. Only let ingredients that have a lot of flavor and that you don't need to do much into your fridge. Like capers, you just put them in the pan. Olives, the same thing. They have a ton of flavor. You don't need to do anything to them, and they're going to enliven your dish, and they're going to make the simplest thing, like a roast chicken breast or a sautéed shrimp, and they're going to turn it into something magnificent and for no effort.
I forgot to mention that a lot of small kitchens have those half refrigerators.
Yes, exactly. And then you really want to be careful of what you put in there. You want to make sure that your condiment collection, mine is out of control because I have a big fridge. If you have a small fridge, pick 4 or 5 of your favorite condiments and keep them at, you know, on hand, and then you can rotate them out. But don't, try not to take up your whole fridge with condiments.
Now, you also recommend on the video chopping less. Don't all the chefs that we see on TV chop up the herbs to a millimeter of their lives?
Yeah. You can do that, but I don't mind the texture. I mean, I think that if you have a very, very refined palate, then maybe a little bit of, you know, the texture of herbs might bother you, but maybe I have a more rustic palate, then I think it's fine, and it saves you time. Time is another thing that none of us have, and I think cooking at home, you want to make your dishes as easy as possible.
A listener wants to know whether you should rinse the capers because they can be rather salty.
If you find your capers too salty, you can rinse them. That's perfectly fine. It depends on the brine solution, just the amount of salt in it. So taste it first before you cook with it. And if you find it salty, then give it a quick rinse. It's a very good tip.
I used to live downstairs from a Chinese chef, and he came into my house and he saw all the pots and pans that were over the stove. I had one of those racks.
Uh-huh.
And he said, too many.
Exactly.
Well, but of course, he was Chinese. He used a wok and he cooked everything in the wok.
Well, you can do that with a skillet. You can cook, if you have maybe, I'd say, a pasta pot, a skillet, and a big baking pan, that's all you really need. You can do so much with that. I mean,
you cook the sauce in one pan. Some people will break it up into 3 or 4 different.
And that's another thing. Try to avoid recipes where you have to break it up into 3 or 4 different pans because they're not going to fit on your stove. Look for one-pot meals. Look for big, you know, recipes you can make in a big skillet and make a pan sauce directly in the pan. That's going to save you the hassle of trying to change pans in the middle of a recipe.
I've taken to cooking pasta in a deep sauce. I don't know what I'm calling it. It's like a large frying pan, but it's rather deep. And fill it up with water, and it doesn't take as long to boil, and it cooks just as well.
Oh, that's a good idea. See, that's another good
idea. Because I used
no
to tell
idea.
You
right.
to just
take a big pot.
Put a lot of water in there. It doesn't matter. The ravioli, the pasta, they cook in the exact same amount of time.
That is a great tip.
Just have to stir it more.
Because it takes, you know, when you have a teeny stove, and the chances are your BTUs are going to be on the low side. Heat up an entire pot of pasta water is going to take 30 minutes. So that's a great tip.
And this takes 10 minutes.
Right. That's perfect.
My guest is Melissa Clark, and we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll take some of your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. She's participated in our Food in the City series, the third installment following the one of me making pancakes and Peter Hoffman walking through the Green Market. And now this one is cooking in a small kitchen, and it's a lot of fun, Melissa. It really is. You look like you had a lot of fun doing it. You also get an interesting recipe, and there are some more tips. We'll come back with those as well. Stay with us. We're back with Melissa Clark, the James Beard Award-winning food writer. How many James Beard Awards have you won?
One.
Oh.
It's still nice.
It's great. I've won 3, by the way.
Congratulations.
But you know, there are differences. I mean, you won them for really knowing what to do. I just talk to people.
I just help chefs write books, so.
And you did the last one with Danielle Ballou?
That one was a few years ago. The last book I just finished was the one you mentioned, A Billion Delicious Desserts, with pastry chef Bill Yoses, who works at the White House right now. It is going to be a fantastic book. That's coming out in 2010 in the fall, and everybody should look for it because they're not quite a billion, but there's at least a couple of 100 recipes, and they're terrific.
Why does it take so long?
It takes so long.
Did they have to test every one of them?
Well, we had to test. We test everything. I test it out of my nice big kitchen now, but before I would test it out of a small kitchen. And the thing about testing a pastry chef's recipes is that they're to scale them up and down, and, you know, I'm scaling them down for the home cook, takes a lot of adjustment. And it takes me at least two or three times to do each recipe because it has to be perfect. You know, if someone's going to – usually people don't bake unless it's a special occasion. And it would just – I'd be so sad if someone – made a recipe and didn't come out perfect for their friend's birthday or for their dinner party. So I'm very particular.
And in the case of baking, you really do have to follow the recipe. It's not that's not where you become creative.
Well, you can be creative if you know exactly what you're doing. Like Bill Yasses, he can be as creative as he wants because he's a master.
So he knows if he adds something, he has to take something out.
He knows if he adjusts the baking powder by a quarter of a teaspoon exactly what the recipe, how it's going to affect the recipe. And unless you know that, I'd say stick to it. Another thing is we used scale for everything, which if you have a small kitchen, I don't know if I would tell you to take up some space with a scale unless you love to bake. But
scales are actually an easier way to really measure accurately than putting stuff into a measuring cup because the density of the flour, for example, or the other things really can vary.
You know, that might be – maybe we should tell people to get rid of your baking cups entirely, get rid of your measuring cups and just get a scale. I mean, you would be more exact and it would take up less room and it's easier.
One of the things you propose is making couscous with this shrimp dish.
Oh, couscous is great for anybody who's either rushed or who has a small kitchen. Couscous is my staple when I forget to make a starch. You know, I'll be cooking, I'll make my you know main course, I'll make my fish, I'll make the salad, and then I'll realize, oh, we have no bread in the house, and I forgot to make pasta, and I didn't make potatoes. I have exactly 5 minutes until dinner is ready. What do I do? And then I make couscous. Because all you have to do is take boiling water, pour it over the couscous and let it sit for 5 minutes. And it's, I mean, I love couscous.
But there's couscous and couscous. Aren't there a wide range, big bead and small bead?
Yeah, this is, I'm talking about the very fine couscous. I always buy whole wheat couscous because it cooks in the same amount of time. And I think it has a nuttier flavor and I like it better. And I feel more virtuous somehow. And then the thing is, you need to add a big pat of butter or a nice drizzle of olive oil to make it really taste special.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. We'll get to the calls in just a moment. But Paul from the West Side wrote in. Well, he called in, actually, and then hung up. He said, do you keep the foil under the burners to keep things neat and clean?
Oh, you know, you can do that. I don't. I tend to... I'm a little bit obsessive about cooking and cleaning. My mother always taught me a good cook cleans as she goes. So as I'm cooking, I actually have a sponge in one hand and a spatula in the other, and I've sauteed my shrimp, and then I've got the sponge, and I wipe up everything as I go, and it doesn't stick and get brown. However, if you are not obsessive like that, then go ahead and put the foil on.
I just don't like the look of the foil.
I don't either. And plus, I think that it's kind of a waste of, you know, resources.
Mm-hmm. Aluminum.
Yeah, aluminum.
We're running out of aluminum.
In general, we should be thinking green.
Steve Miller from Scarsdale says on our show page, if there's a window on you in your kitchen, you can use the fire escape to temporarily store hot pots.
That is a great idea. I've never.
Although I think that the fire department might not like that idea.
How often? Yeah, you think they're checking in New York?
Well,
aren't they busy?
If you put a barbecue thing outside,
that's true.
They will come by and they'll give you a ticket.
Well, but a big bunch of pots, you can just pull them in. If you see them rescuing the kitten that's stuck in the tree right nearby, then you know that it's time to pull your pots in.
Let's take a call. Lloyd from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask you, they sell these charts where in the chart it pairs the appropriate herb and spice for every category dish. For example, poultry, fish, lamb, pork. Mm-hmm. And I'm missing one of those because I have a lot of spices. Sometimes I forget which goes with what. Any suggestions where I can find one and buy one?
You know, I'll bet your friend the internet you'll probably be able to get one for free, is my guess, if you look it up online. But that's a really good point about having a lot of herbs and spices. I think, I don't know if you get into a rut and use the same ones over and over again.
Yeah, what I do is I use a lot of spicings to put a little pizzazz in an ordinary dish.
Right.
Make it taste a lot better and kind of give it zing.
There's a wonderful book by Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg called The Flavor Bible, in which they talk about what goes well with what. Rather than giving you recipes, they suggest that certain spices go well with certain foods or other spices.
Oh, great. I can look that up on Amazon. What's the author's name again? I'm sorry.
Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg. Do you know the book?
Yeah, that's a great – I forgot about that. Thank you. That's a fabulous book.
Thank you for calling us. Our number, by the way, 212- 833-9692. Before we get some more calls, I was just thinking about some of the things you said earlier about what not to buy. Microwave?
If you heat up food a lot, then I would say buy a microwave and keep it in your living room. Keep it on your table in your living room where you eat. Don't keep it in your kitchen. I think it's probably not the most necessary thing. I think better to have a food processor actually than a microwave for that amount of space, because it really only does one thing. It heats up food. Okay, it melts chocolate and it melts butter, but I think everything you let into your kitchen should have many purposes.
Well, it helps you to defrost.
It does help you. That's true. Yeah, I guess you have to know your lifestyle. Do you have a freezer in your – you might not even have a freezer if you have a teeny weeny little fridge. So.
And you came into the studio and you said, I heard that you bought a salad spinner. And I wasn't sure whether I was being judged harshly.
No. Okay, that's another thing. I am a salad fanatic. I eat salad at every single dinner. And so for me, a salad spinner is non-negotiable. In my smallest kitchens, I always have a salad spinner. And then what I do is I store things in my salad spinner. But if you don't eat salads, then, you know, make a choice. Know what you like to eat and what you like to cook. Another thing is you can buy pre-washed greens these days. So, you know, if you think I'm just going to be buying stuff in the bags, then you don't need a salad spinner.
First of all, I think you have to eat salad because it's good for your intestinal tract.
And so. It's delicious. I think salad is one of the most underrated parts of a meal. Every night, I say, I get very happy making my salads, and I use different oils and different vinegars and different lettuces, and I'm a big salad proponent. So go out there and make a salad you've never made before.
Barbara from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I have a question about frying pans. I know that some of them have vertical sides, a 90-degree angle, and some of them have slanty sides.
Right.
And if I'm just getting one, which kind should I get? What different purposes do they serve?
Well, the one with the curved sides is technically called a skillet, and the one with the with the kind of the vertical sides, you know, the 90-degree angle sides, I think is called a frying pan. I would say get the one with the vertical sides because you have more options on how to use it. The reason they have those slope sides is, have you seen on television when the chefs take the frying pan and they take the food and they kind of go swish and the food flips over? Do you know what I'm talking about? It slides up the sides, not for just for omelets, but yes, definitely you can use it for omelets, but also when they're kind of flipping the food in the pan. Mm-hmm. And they're sucking.
It looks great on television.
Exactly.
Don't try it at home.
Yeah, if you're going to do that at home, then you need the curved sides. If you're not going to do that, then I would say you'll have more flexibility with the straight sides. And you can make pasta, like Leonard was just talking about. You can heat the water in your pan. You can use it for sauces. And you can the cover will fit very tightly, and you can even braise meats in it.
Uh-huh.
So okay. I would say go for that one.
Thank you.
Okay, Barbara, thank you. And Ishmael from Queens, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm retired, and I love cooking, and I use cutting boards, you know, not frequently, but every so often. And I wonder which one is better, the plastic or the wooden one.
That is an interesting question because there's some debate about that. I personally like the wooden ones. I think they're sturdier. I like the way they feel. I like the way they look a lot better. But if you're cutting a meat and fish, there is, and especially chicken, there's some worry that they're not as hygienic. There's some studies that shown that they're actually just fine. But then there is a worry that you can't put them in the dishwasher and get them really, really clean. Of course, if you have a small kitchen, you probably don't have a dishwasher. But I would say that it depends. I mean, do you cook a lot of meat and chicken? What's your favorite thing to cook?
Meat, chicken,
yeah.
Fish.
Yeah, so I would say that if you're worried about germs, if that's a big concern, I would say you could get and you'd feel safer getting a plastic one that you can really, you know, put under boiling water, then you should do that one. If you're less worried or if you cook more vegetables, then I would say the wooden one is fine.
Actually, I have both.
Oh, you have both. Well, that's perfect. So then you can use one for vegetables, and you can use I would say keep the plastic one and make that your designated meat cutting board.
Okay.
And then anytime you cut chicken or fish or meat, you'll use that board, and then you can run it, you know, put some boiling water on it to sterilize it or really put it in the dishwasher if you have one. And then you use your wooden one for everything else.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Sure,
thank you for calling us. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopez talking with Melissa Clark, a frequent contributor to the Wednesday Food section of the New York Times, where she writes a good appetite column. And there's going to be a book coming out?
There is. It's very exciting. It's going to come out also in 2010 in the fall. And the book is going to be similar to the column in that there'll be a little essay and then a recipe, but it'll be pretty much all new content. And it'll be a little more memoir-y, personal than what I'm allowed to write about in the Times. So.
You have all sorts of wonderful tips. You ran out of paper towels at one point. You had a suggestion for what to do instead.
Well, paper towels are another one of those, you know, saving resources. And we should use our cloth towels a lot more often than we do. I like to keep a stack of clean cloth towels, just regular dish towels. I always have them in my kitchen. And I use them for things that people would normally use paper towels for, like blotting dry. When you rinse a piece of fish or a piece of chicken, you can blot it dry. You can use a towel for that, you know, then just put it in your wash.
And it doesn't stick to the fish.
It doesn't stick to the fish, and it doesn't, you don't get those little bits of paper towel everywhere. And I just also like the feel of it better. It absorbs water a lot better. If you have a spill, use a cloth towel. It absorbs things better.
And as my producer points out, you can use a towel when you're drying the greens for your salad.
That's right. If you don't have a salad spinner, this is what I do when I'm in someone else's kitchen and I'm cooking if they don't have a salad spinner. You wash your greens, you shake them as well as you can, and you wrap them in a kitchen towel, and then you just shake it really hard.
One of the tips that I'm going to use from now on is about squeezing a lemon. On the video, you squeeze a lemon, and you don't have to use anything other than your hands.
That's right. If you don't have one of those lemon reamers which catches the seeds, just take your lemon half, squeeze it over your other hand, and let the juice fall through your fingers, and the seeds will just collect in your hand. You just throw it out. So there's another piece of equipment you don't need is a lemon reamer.
Our next caller is Tim from Manhattan. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi there. This is a terrific show, I got to say. And I believe I've used every principle that has been mentioned so far on the show. I just want to add something else, and that is when you're doing a multi-course meal, I found it really useful to heat up certain components of the meal to a certain point, and then when they're ready to be served, you can finish them. And I would keep these things hot by stacking the pots on top of the stove. I had a 24-inch stove, and very often there was something in the oven as well, and that would keep everything warm. However, I have one question, and that is, what do you do about ventilation? Ventilation is the biggest problem I find in New York kitchen.
Especially if you have a smoke detector that goes off, even if you have one of those ventilating vents there.
Yeah. Yeah, those ventilating vents usually don't do anything. They blow it right back into the room is what I found. The first thing I do is take the battery out of the smoke detector before I start cooking and then remember to put it back in.
But people do complain. You cook certain things and they say, isn't there a lot of smoke here? Or the whole place smells of steak.
Yeah, exactly. It's a problem. And if you don't have a window in your kitchen and you can't open the window, I mean, there's not that much you can do. I mean, did you have a trick for this when you were in your small kitchen?
Well, in the small kitchen, happily, I was on the top floor. And what I would do is I'd go up on the roof and I remove the ventilating cap on the skylight. It had one of these really old skylights. And I just pried it off and then air would rush in. But of course, not being on the top floor now, it's terrible. I mean, when guests come over, I've got every fan going, every window open. You know, it could be the middle of winter, but there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, I mean, okay, this is what I do. I have a little system. When I make latkes, I have a latke party every year, you know, potato pancakes, and they stink up the house. So what I do is I take one of those window fans and I turn it backwards so that it's sucking the air out instead of, you know, pulling the air in. Do you know what I'm talking about? I put one of those in the window in the kitchen, and then I have another fan pointing it right by the stove that points the all the smoke toward the window fan, and it sucks it out. And it's not great, but it's helpful. So I would say if you can come up with a little system like that, just remember to put it in backwards so that you're sucking the air out.
Right.
Okay, thank you for calling us. I was thinking of some of the other solutions that you have to come up with if you're in a small space because you have smaller cabinets. You've got to buy smaller things, but they are more expensive generally.
You know, that's a good point. In my old apartment, I couldn't put my big white IKEA dishes in my cabinet because I couldn't shut the cabinet door. So I ended up having to put them in I'd have to stack them vertically instead of stacking them, you know, horizontally, which was a real pain because they would be always constantly on the verge of falling. So, yeah, you do have to look for things that fit in your cabinets.
When did you catch the cooking fever? How old were you?
I was a kid. I've been cooking since I made my first whole meal for my parents when I was 8 years old. You know, my parents are big foodies. I hope they're listening, and they will appreciate this. And they always taught me everything. You know, when they were cooking, they would show me. They'd say, "Hey, this is a garlic press," or "This is, you know, this is how to hold a knife." When I was, you know, 8, 9, 10, and I loved being able to make the food that I wanted to eat. I loved being able to season something and have it just come alive in the pan. You know, you start out with something that just looks like, you know, a chicken breast doesn't look like anything when you take it out of the package, and you put it in the pan and you heat it up and you just add salt and an herb or a spice or one thing, and it's delicious. And to me, that alchemy was just miraculous. And I still get kind of goosebumpy when it happens.
We have some people who have hung up, but there are questions that I remember. Two related ones. One wonders whether you can use a postage scale for baking, and the other wonders whether when you are measuring flour, for example, are we talking sifted or unsifted?
Okay, the sifted, unsifted question is a really big question in test kitchens. In professional test kitchens, it's the kind of thing we talk about. Because the fact is that recipes historically have expected you to sift. But these days, I don't know anyone who sifts. Do you sift when you bake? No.
I don't think I have a sifter anymore.
Well, of course. And then there's that it takes up a lot of space. This is what I do. And I think this is what most people do these days when we're creating recipes, is you take, I take my flour canister. The flour has gotten packed down and I just give it a stir. And so I kind of fluff it up a little bit, but I don't actually sift it. And then I'll do the recipe from there. If you're weighing something, obviously, you're going to get a weight on it, so it's not as important. But I think that in general, that's a good tip, is just to give your flour a little stir, and it'll fluff it up before you start cooking.
The problem with the postal scales is they tend to be not take very much weight.
They're not, right. And not only that,
they don't do pounds.
They're just by each ounce, right? So if you have if you need grams, and a lot of baking recipes, you do need grams, you won't be able to make that conversion without a calculator.
A reminder that the recipe for Melissa Clark shrimp with feta can be found on our show page at WNYC.org. You can also watch her. We have a video that we have posted of her cooking in her friend's kitchen. For part four in the Food in the City series, next Tuesday the 30th, we will be joined by Julie Powell, who wrote Julie and Julia, and she'll be talking about cooking with the ingredients you have on hand. Just you come home, you open up the refrigerator or look in the cabinet, and you realize that you're not exactly sure how to use those ingredients to make something that you'd want to eat.
Well, that's the thing about a small kitchen. You probably don't have anything on hand. So whatever you're cooking, you've just brought back with you from the store. So in a way, you've got an advantage.
And we also want to involve you, our listeners, in this series. If you have a secret ingredient that transforms a recipe or a favorite dish that you've made all your own, send it in. And Chef Michael LaMonica will be going through them all, and then he'll pick his favorite dish, and then he'll cook it with the winner in his restaurant kitchen. To submit your recipe, visit our show page at WNYC.org. And Melissa, thank you so much for coming by. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
It's been a pleasure.